So I'm Peter Kelly, and this is my third Mad World and my first time presenting. And I'm here to talk about a case study. I work for Visa for how we converted our Visa Rules publication to Madcap Flare. Thought I'd start with a little bit about myself. So I'm a director in the business operations group within client services at Visa. I have 25 years of experience in the software industry managing various software applications. I'm like what I like to refer to as a hybrid, which means I'm half business and half technical, and I can translate between the two. So I had started off at one point to become a software developer, and I learned the database side of things, and I've also done some project management, software QA, and some technical writing, so I'm a bit of a jack of all trades. I even used RoboHelp back in the 90s when it was out as well. And then I would find myself in meetings, and I would be translating between developers and business people. So basically what I would find is the business people would say to the developers, oh, we would like the software to do this. The developers would get kind of a puzzled look on their face, and I'd look at them and I'd say, well, they mean this. And they go, oh, okay. And then they'd say something back to the business folks. The business folks would get the puzzled look on their face, and so I'd say, well, they mean this. And so I kind of turned what comes natural for me into a career, really, and since then I've been more of a product owner for various software applications, doing some technical things and some business things, as well as developing requirements and that type of thing. And so at Visa, besides our Flare implementation, I manage our content publishing system and our Google Analytics implementation for Visa Online, which is our extranet platform for our client financial institutions. All right. And so what are the Visa rules? So the Visa rules govern the participation of our financial institution clients in the Visa system and are comprised of the Visa core rules and more specific Visa product and service rules. So the core rules apply to everybody, and then the product and service rules kind of apply to what you're doing with Visa, whether you're issuing cards to cardholders or acquiring merchant transactions or processing or whatever you might be doing. And the Visa rules publication is produced twice annually with two versions, one for our clients, and a redacted public version, which there's a link to here, and you'll be able to go take a look at that. And here we'll take a look at that here in just a moment. So, and what a rule looks like is this. It has a four-level deep section number and a title, content. Now, this is often tables or other things, although we don't have any graphics. And then the blue bit at the bottom is what we call our rule ID bar, where it has a unique ID number for the rule, as well as an addition date and a last updated date. So, and at this point, I thought I would also show what the actual publication looks like. Now, this is our public version. So this one is only 870 pages. So this is the short version. So the other one's about 1150, if I'm not mistaken. And you can see over here on the left, it drills down pretty far. And this is our hierarchy here. If you go to the top, each chapter starts like this. And a table of contents, a list of tables, and then we have a glossary that's formatted a bit differently at the end. So it's basically a very large, highly formatted PDF document. Lots of different page layouts and this sort of thing. So that's what a rule looks like. Exciting stuff, isn't it? So in the problem that we were trying to solve, so our previous Visa Rules application was a custom-built solution, and it did the job it was designed for pretty well, but there were some challenges. So it was built and maintained by a third-party vendor, and we wanted to eliminate that dependency and be able to do things more on our own. And because it was a custom software application, every change required a custom development effort, which was not only expensive, but it took a long time. So the lead time to make any changes really at all was probably a couple of months at least as we went through requirements gathering, and then they would do the development, and then we'd have to test it as well. And so all of this takes time. And it could only produce the Visa rules, and we had a need to produce other publications out of the same application. We also have rules for Interlink and Plus, a couple of our other Visa products, and we wanted to single source that content because a lot of it is very similar. But we couldn't do that with our existing application. It was going to be fairly expensive to make it do that. And in addition, this application had dedicated servers because it did have a VOL client-facing, a Visa Online client-facing component at one time. And so we had 22 servers for the across four different environments for this. And it was very challenging to maintain all that. And just to talk a little bit about our previous application, so that was a web-based ASP.NET application, which had two database components, a MarkLogic unstructured XML database, which stored content very much like what the content looks like in Flare Topics, basically HTML behind the scenes, and also a SQL server for the associated relational data. Let's see, and we had the production environment alone had seven servers with two load-balanced web servers, two load-balanced application servers, and then three database servers, and we had three other environments besides that, a couple testing environments and a business resumption planning environment for disaster recovery. And so just keeping all the servers patched and up to date was a ton of work. So our challenge was to convert our Visa Rules publication process from this custom application to a more flexible product. Now, we needed to retain the same format for our highly formatted 1,100-plus page PDF document that I showed you, and we needed also to make it easy for our 20-plus content authors to be able to make changes to the rules, which they work on for 6 months at a time. It's a distributed global team, so we have authors all over the world. And we wanted to reduce the cost and the time to market for changes as well. So we could easily make changes quickly rather than having to wait 2 or 3 months to make a change to something. And we wanted to easily allow for publishing of additional publications beyond the Visa rules. So how did we decide to use Flare? So we considered several products we already had in-house. One of those was Adobe Experience Manager, which we do use to manage our content management system for Visa Online. But that meant the authoring was going to have to be done in FrameMaker. And our writers are more business writers than they are technical writers, and so they really didn't want to have to look at tags when they didn't have to, and so they weren't too keen on using FrameMaker. And so we also went through a request for proposal process, and that's how we actually found out about Flare, because they were one of the vendors that responded to our proposal request. Another one that looked pretty good is called SDL, which is does enterprise-level content authoring and management software, but that was quite costly. And so that was really why we didn't go with that option. And so the other options either didn't meet our needs, like AEM, Adobe Experience Manager really didn't. They weren't user-friendly, like FrameMaker is not the most user-friendly software in the world for writers, or they were just too expensive, like SDL. So, but Flare did all of these things. It met our needs, it was easy enough to use, and it was within our budget. So it was actually a pretty easy choice in the end. So what happened next? So we licensed Flare, and then we started planning. We got a 30-user license to cover all our authors and then a couple more, and then we formed a project team. And that was seven people, two people on the business side, but with some technical knowledge, and this was included myself. Also, my colleague, Andrew Staten, is here in the audience today, if you want to give a wave, Andrew. And he was the other person on the business side. And then we had two people on the IT side, one which is more of a straight software developer and a manager of software developers, and one that was a Flare consultant that we brought on just for the project. And then we also had two technical writers from our London office, which had just undergone a similar Flare conversion effort, and so they had a lot of experience in that area, which really helped a lot because they were able to kind of show us what to do and, more importantly, what not to do, and we were able to avoid some common pitfalls by using their expertise. And, of course, we had to have a project manager, right, because you got to keep us on track or who knows what we'll do. Okay, so planning. So we had an off-site planning workshop that we had in Austin, Texas, because that's where the developers resided, and it was kind of halfway between us and California and the folks in London. And we came up with a schedule, made key decisions, assigned tasks, and determined a training approach, kind of the standard stuff that you would do in any project. And so what were some of the key decisions we made? So let's see, and I'm going to go through these quickly because I'm going to go through each of them in a little bit more detail in subsequent slides. But I'll show some of our actual project here after I go through this first slide. So we decided we would convert our existing XML-based data to DITA so it could be imported into Flare because Flare wouldn't take it in its native format. And then each visa rule would be its own Flare topic, which, like the example rule I showed you, which meant we had almost 2,500 topics. And then we decided to add our unique rule IDs to our topic file names. And we would use a flat folder structure, which means we have the majority of our topics in one big folder, which I'll show here in a second. But we would import our existing folder hierarchy to create our master TOC. And then our heading topics would replace our TOC level folders and would be stored in a different folder within Flare. So let me show a little bit of that. Okay, so this is our Flare project. Here's one of our rules here. And then you can see over here on the left, this is all our topics. And you can see they have their unique ID number here on the left, which makes it easy to look for which topic you're looking for if you know the number. And as I scroll through this, you can see it's a very large list. So almost all the topics are here. And then these are our header topics here. So these are the ones that we used, and I'll show our master TOC to make our hierarchy. So basically, all these topics here are header topics, and then they drill down to where we actually have the content, which is at this level here. So, and if I take a look at one of these topics, that's all it really has. It just has a formatted header and for whichever level it's at, and no content at all. So if I go into the TOC, but if I were to open any of these topics, and you can see this is a pretty short one. This is where all the content actually lives. Okay. So some more key decisions. Key attributes would also be included as topic content for author visibility, but would be excluded from our PDF output. And by that, what I mean, picture's worth 1,000 words, right? So that's this stuff here, which has the location of where this topic is in the book. It has the person who owns the rule, and it has the classification for this, which this rule happens to be public. Our confidential rules are marked as private. Again, this information does not show up in our output. So if I go back to our output in our Word document, you can see none of that shows here. We just have the actual rule information. Then we determined our cross-reference formats for both. We have topic-to-topic links. You know, we have one topic. We'll say, for more information, see this other topic in this other section. And then we have a lot of footnotes as well, where we have footnote numbering, and then if you click on the footnote in the PDF, it'll take you actually to the footnote, or click on the footnote reference, it'll take you to the footnote itself. We also came up with an auto-numbering strategy that was devised to accommodate for those four-level section numbers I mentioned. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute because we did some cool stuff with that for our public version, so it still accounts for the numbers even though there's sections that aren't in that publication. And then we came up with potential formatting options for our rule ID bars and our glossary. So then the technical execution. We took our plan and we began to act on it, importing the data into Flare and building out the various components. So getting the data into Flare, this turned out to be a little bit more challenging than we had hoped. We got our software vendor to write an export script for us from our custom application to extract our content and our attributes, some of the metadata about our content, into an XML format. And from there, our IT lead then wrote a Python script to convert the XML data into a DITA format, which we then used to import into Flare. Because Flare will take DITA, but it will not take in raw XML. And that was really the main task that we really needed a developer for. Once we got past this, we were really able to do most of the rest of the work by ourselves without that level of technical expertise. So, and then we did also try importing the data from Word, rather than doing it from Ditta initially, and that just wasn't really very clean and brought in a lot of unnecessary formatting and was going to require quite extensive cleanup, which is when our IT person came up with the idea of converting it to Ditta. And so that worked out much better. And even though it was a lot cleaner, we did encounter a few issues along the way with that. So import challenges. So we used our existing rule and heading titles for our file names, which were very long. We hit the Windows file path limit of 260 characters, and so we had to truncate some of the file names and shorten our overall project folder structure. Flare, when you import data into a new Flare project, it also uses a temporary file location that has quite a fair amount of folders in it, and so we had some troubles with that as well, so we kind of had to work on that a little bit, and it was a lot of trial and error to get the topic names short enough to where we could actually get everything imported. So that was one challenge. And also, we had some duplicate heading titles, and Flare added numbers to the end of the duplicated file names. Now, that wasn't such a big deal, and we accounted for it after the fact by renaming some of the topics and consolidating some of the other topics, which we did end up unconsolidating down the road, because then that would cause issues if we had to condition one for use in a particular book in one section, but we were using it in two places and it didn't need to be conditioned in the other one, for example. So we ended up splitting those back out. And in hindsight, it would have been better just to make those all unique to begin with and not go through the whole duplication process. But you know, you learn these things as you go. And so while we got the data as clean as we could, we still had some post-import HTML reformatting work to do in Flare to apply some styles and move things around. And we used Flare's Find and Replace for this. Find and Replace turned out to be a very powerful tool for us. We used it in conjunction with regular expressions to reformat a lot of the data. And you can use that for those of you that have used it. You know, you can reformat many topics at the same time by doing that. And so we found that to be very useful, and I'm actually giving a full presentation on that and some of the things we did tomorrow. So if you'd like to learn more about Find and Replace, then come see me tomorrow morning at 11. So, and a little bit more detail on some of these things now. So for the Find and Replace, we did things like taking this top example, which is the file tags and our metadata, and reformatting it so it looked like it did down below at the bottom. The file tags are actually showing in the content there in the XML view at the top, where after we reformatted them using Find and Replace, they no longer showed because you don't really need to see the file tags in the content. And we reformatted what the rest of it looks like as well. So, and again, I'll give some, go through some in-depth examples of that in my presentation tomorrow. So our folder structure. We imported our folder structure to create our master TOC, as I mentioned, and we used the Ditta map to do that. Then we replaced the folders with the H1-only topics. So as you can see, there at the top, they're nested, and then basically we took them all out, put them into that flat folder I showed that I scrolled through earlier. So heading topics. We moved these empty heading topics into their own folder to more easily manage them. And again, they're only used for grouping our rule content, which is always at the same level. So that's, and I showed an example of this before, but there's just another example of what it looks like and then how they display in our PDF. So the one showing there is a top level one, like you can see for that ATM chapter there on the bottom image. So key attributes. We display key pieces of metadata in our topics for author reference and review output, but exclude them from our final publication output. So cross-references. We came up with custom styles for our topic-to-topic links and our footnotes. excuse me. Now, some of this is fairly standard stuff, and this is the CSS from our style sheet here. The topic-to-topic links, it says section, and then it has the section number, and then it has the paratext, which is just the the title of the topic we're linking to. And then in the footnote code in the bottom, it's basically doing a superscripted 8-point font number. And then the cool one I wanted to show at the bottom, where it has the madcap xref footnote plus madcap xref footnote, is we have our footnotes together sometimes, which I'll show in the document, and this actually will insert the comma that's needed in between for us. So I don't know if you can see this here. Maybe I'll make it a little bit larger. But you can see here we have these footnotes, and all those commas are automatically inserted by the CSS for us in Flare. By using that, by stringing them together and then putting the comma in there here. Section numbers. Auto numbering was used for our four-level section numbers and also included a no-num class and a redaction class for our public version. So the reason we have these extra classes is some of our chapters are not actually numbered with section numbers. We have an introduction, for example, that does not get the numbers, so we use that class for that. And we also have an appendix that does not get numbered. And then for the redaction class, this allows us to account for it in the TOC but not display it. And so if you can see here on this bottom slide, we're actually skipping from 4.13.1 to 4.13.3 because for the sake of transparency, we want folks looking at our public version to know there's actually content here that we're not showing you. So that was kind of cool to be able to do that. And then our glossary and our rule ID bars. Our glossary and rule ID bars needed special formatting, which we achieved through table styles. So even though this looks like a large table, each of these rows here is actually a single topic, and they're just strung together in the way they're output through the CSS, one on top of each other with the letters inserted in the middle. And then again, you see the rule ID bar that I showed before, which in this case is really a table embedded within a table. So our authoring process. We also needed to replicate our proposal-based authoring process, both for internal review purposes and to maintain an audit trail of all rule changes. So what is a proposal? So a proposal is a set of rule changes being made for a specific business purpose. So now the visa rules are a legally binding document for our clients. And so we can't just go changing them, you know, without going through extensive review and that sort of thing. And a proposal can include changes to existing rules, addition of new rules, and deletion of rules that are no longer applicable or relevant. And so basically, if we want to change rules for a specific purpose, you'll collect all the rules that you need to change into a proposal. You'll mark up the changes, and then you'll send it out to review, and ultimately it goes to an executive review committee, but lots of other folks along the way. So the way we do that is we use a separate TOC for each proposal. And this also allows us to track what's being changed by people. And multiple people across our global team often include the same rules and different proposals for different business purposes. So we might be working, two or three different people might be working on the same topic at the same time. And this is kind of a way for us to track who's working on it and for what purpose. And then when the author is ready, the proposal, as I mentioned, is sent out for internal review. Okay, so how do we do all this in Flare? In Flare, we use the track changes feature to show the changes to the rule language. And again, each rule is a topic in Flare. And we use a word target to export the rules proposal with its track changes for reviews. The author can then reject the changes made by other authors for other projects before sending it out for review. So if Andrew and I are each working on the same topic, once I export it, then I can go in and reject his changes. And if I do that in the Word document, then I'm not impacting the content in Flare where his changes can stay. And then once he puts his proposal out, if mine hasn't been approved yet, then he can do the same thing. And once a given proposal is approved, the topic changes are also then accepted. And we do that, we have a single person do that for all proposals rather than the author writing the proposal. It's one person to, it's job to go in and basically check to make sure that what was approved in the Word document, in case something got changed after it got exported, which does happen occasionally. So they need to make sure that what was approved actually matches what is in Flare and that they're actually accepting so that the approved changes are what make it into the project. So the key benefits to this approach is our proposal-based process. It allows our 20-plus authors globally to work on changes to the same rules at the same time. And Flare's biggest benefit is that they can see each other's changes in real time in order to detect potential conflicts. So if we're both working on the topic with track changes in there, I can see the changes that are tracked by the other author, so I know what they're changing. And in our old tool, you couldn't do that. In our old tool, when you worked on a rule, it, like Flare, each one was essentially like in a kind of a topic format. But you would check that rule out, and it would then make a copy of it that you would work on. And so other authors could also work on the same rule and check out and make their own copy, but you couldn't see each other's changes. So you wouldn't necessarily know what if your changes were going to impact the other person's or vice versa, which, as you can guess, was a problem once in a while. Sure. Yes, we do use source control for that. We use Microsoft Team Foundation Server, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in just a minute. But yeah, we certainly did. And one of the main reasons for that is for audit purposes as well. You know, being a legally binding document, we have to track all these changes, and we occasionally have to go back and look at what was changed and why and for various reasons. And also, the other big benefit, which I've already talked about, is the fact that changes for one proposal can be accepted while leaving the changes for the other proposal intact. Now, our old tool, you couldn't do that either. So basically, in our old tool, first one in, one. So if I made a bunch of changes and Andrew made a bunch of changes and his proposal got approved first, then his went in, well, then I had to go back and remake all my changes again on top of the changes he made. And you can guess the authors just loved it when they had to go in and do that. Yeah, and now we get to source control. So as I mentioned, we use TFS for our source control. And why and how we use TFS. So for us, I know Git is often preferred for Flare from what I've heard in the other conferences and just from talking to other Flare users. But we had an enterprise license for TFS. Also, a team was in place to support it. And so it was really at no cost to us, no project cost. And since we had the internal support folks and everybody in place already, it was kind of a no-brainer for us to just go ahead and use TFS. And for the most part, it works all right. We have issues with it once in a while, but it's not bad. And since we had many mass changes to make to the content, though, doing all that finding and replacing, we waited until the Flare project was completely set up before we connected it to TFS. When we first started this effort, We weren't sure if this was going to work out, right? Flare was new to us, and, you know, the rules have to come out on time. It's legally binding and all that, so we kind of had to have a fallback plan. So what we did was we continued to use our old software simultaneously with Flare for a while, and so we were doing data entry in both places till we got far enough along with Flare to where we knew we were going to be okay, and that's when we connected it to source control and started using that. So for a while, we were just kind of sharing copies of the project on the LAN as we cleaned it up and whatnot. So we also have multiple TFS environments set up with copies of our live projects so we can try things out without impacting our production content. So we have a QA project set up and a development project. So if we really want to try doing something different, we have the ability to go in and do that. So training. We conducted multiple training sessions in multiple geographies to accommodate our distributed global team. So, and training for us was a key to user adoption. People often dislike change, and our authors were really no exception. They had to modify the way they work a bit to use Flare, and we wanted to make that a positive experience for them. So we flew the core project team around to do in-person training sessions wherever it was possible so we could maximize the buy-in from our authors. And we did do conference call training sessions as well for locations where there were only one or two authors where it didn't make sense to fly people there. And we also took detailed feedback and suggestions during the training on how to make the project better because we wanted everyone's voice to be heard and for them to feel like they were partners in the process of switching tools rather than they were just having a new tool forced upon them. As anyone who's ever worked for a large company knows, that can happen. Okay, so now we're using Flare. Now what? So we needed to tackle two more things, translations and single sourcing multiple publications, which is one of the reasons we switched to Flare in the first place for the multiple publications. So the single source challenges. So we needed to produce a public version of our rules from the same source, which is a subset of our full rules, and that's the document I showed you earlier. And we also wanted to single source our translations, some of which were region-specific subsets of our full rules content. For example, we do a book for Brazil, and it only has what's relevant to Brazil. It doesn't have things that are not relevant to them in there. So, and we also wanted to set this up in such a way that as the need for other subset translations came up, because you never know when we're going to be asked by the central bank in a particular country to come up with a version in their language. So we wanted to set the project up so it was kind of already set to handle them. So we took that into thought when we did this as well. And then we also wanted to produce rule books for three of our other products, which reuse much of that same content, as I mentioned previously. So advanced conditions came to our rescue. So regular conditions worked at first when we did just our public version and one other product, but this quickly became unworkable due to too many possibilities. You know, we would be canceling, the conditions would be canceling each other out essentially when we tried to run the various targets. So we held a multi-day conditioning summit with the core business team and kind of hashed through different options. And in the end, advanced conditions offered the flexibility we needed. You do have to be very careful with them due to their complexity, but they offer nearly unlimited possibilities in what you can do. And so our conditions, and there's even more of them in here now than when I put the slides together a few months back. So we have conditions that you can see here for our public versus confidential rules there at the top. Each of our six regions, that's how we are divide the globe up at Visa, and some of our countries and each of our publications. So you can see there's quite a few conditions in there, and again, there's even more now. So here's an example of what our advanced conditions look like from our Brazil translation to show how complex it can get. And what I've done with this, and when I write the conditions, this is generally what I do, is I have the parentheses color-coded so you can see the nesting more easily, so I can kind of tell where the pairs match up and what it's doing a little bit better. So when I have to change these, I tend to work on this outside of the tool in a Word document and go through it and figure out the nesting and all that, and then when I go to test it, then I just paste the whole thing into the advanced conditions tab in Flare. And that works out pretty well for me. And it's a lot easier than using that little box to write them in that comes in Flare. So a bit about translations. We use Lingo for our translations. Our translation vendor was familiar with the tool and its industry standard XLIF output format, and they welcomed the change. And one of the reasons our vendor welcomed the change is because they used to have to build our translated PDF for us. So that also meant any time we changed the format, not only did we have to change our custom application, then we had to have our translation vendor change their PDF output to match that. And as you might imagine, our translation vendor really wants to do translation. They don't really want to be building PDFs for us. That was really just the only way they could get our business previously. And so, but with Flare, they don't have to do that anymore because now we can produce our own translated PDFs that our vendor used to produce, which means we're in full control. So if we need to make format changes, we can just go do it and The translated version gets done too, and our translation vendor can just translate, so they're happier, we're happier, so it worked out great. Now, we don't connect our Lingo project to TFS, as the performance impact to doing that was significant due to our unusually large number of topics. So we did try and do that, but we found just to open the Lingo project in Flare took 10 or 15 minutes, so it was pretty unworkable, whereas the Flare project itself opens, I don't know, within about 30 or 40 seconds, I would say. This is comparative. So we did run into some TFS issues there. Okay, so I wanted to talk about some Flare tips and some cool features that we learned along the way and show two of my favorite new features. This is actually from Flare 2018. We haven't taken a look at the 2019 version that just came out because then we have to distribute it to our authors, but as soon as we get back from the conference, I think we will be looking at that because it looks like it has some cool stuff in it. All right, some Flare project tips. So using a unique ID in your topic content and file names makes find and replace tasks and using the quick find more efficient and also makes topic organization easier. I don't know how many of you use the quick find, but I did want to show that. It's a very simple little thing. But if I know my topic number, because I have a unique ID in there, I can just type it in there and then it pops up. And then I can select it and open it very easily instead of scrolling through my huge list over here, which I showed you previously. So that's kind of a nice thing. And then for us, instead of deleting our topics, we moved them to a separate deleted items folder so that we can keep an audit trail for them. So if I scroll up here, we keep all the deleted rules up here so that we can still reference them. And having them in a different folder also makes it easier when you're searching for things using the find and replace to exclude them by just not picking that folder as part of where you're searching. And then if you have targets that change their source TOC a lot, if you're using source control, don't check them in if that's all you've changed. Because if you can just undo the checkout to avoid creating unnecessary source control records. And what I mean by that is for us, I have one of our targets open. This is our proposals target. And if I go here, now you can see these are all our proposals here. These are all complete, the ones here. But if I go down a bit further, actually, if I go up, here's some other ones that were being worked on for our recent publication. And so what I would do as an author is I would change this and then I would build it. And once I click on build here, then it's going to check it out for me from TFS and save it. And so rather than checking it in, there's really no reason to do that. I can just undo the checkout and then we don't end up with tons of source control records for those targets. Find and replace tips. So when you're doing a find and replace, one of the most useful things is to save your result set first. So find and replace is here. If I just do a simple one. We'll put this back to regular text. So when you do your find all, now if I'm actually going to change this to something else and do a replace after this, first if I go here, this is export results to CSV. Well, to just open up a little Windows dialog and you can save off what you're changing. That way you basically have a list of all the topics you changed so that if you ever need to go back and look at them or if you did make an error or something, then you kind of have something to go back to because it won't keep track of it for you automatically if you don't do that. And then another find and replace tip is if you use find and replace with source control, Flare checks out the impacted topics for you, and then you can review them for errors before checking them in and just undo the checkout if you made a mistake. So the nice thing about source control is it doesn't automatically save them. when you're using a non-source control bound project that's just on your laptop, and you do a find and replace, unless you have all the topics you're doing that to open, then it's going to go ahead and make that change and save each of those topics too. So you have to be very careful with it so you don't end up saving something you didn't intend to. Okay, so my favorite new Flare features that, did come out in 2018, so they're not so new anymore, but they're still some of my favorite. So our authors spend a lot of time researching what rules need to go into their proposals, and they use the find and replace in this. And so a couple of things you can do now that you didn't used to be able to do. So you can see down here, this one topic came back four times, probably even more than that if I scroll down, because that's every instance of the word compliance, it's flagging. But now one of the things that you can do is you can go into the result options and you can tell it, just show me the first result per file, which essentially limits it to only showing each topic once. So if I do that, let's stop this find and do a find all again. And you can see as it's starting to scroll through and do the find, now it's only showing each topic once instead of four times. And then the other cool thing you can do, if I open one of these proposals, which is again for us just a TOC. So now what I can do is I can drag topics directly from here into my TLC, which is really nice, and just drop it in there like that. Now, I'm not going to leave that one in there, but nonetheless, it used to be in order to do this, the steps you used to have to go through to get a topic into the TLC before they introduced this is you would have to open the topic, and then you would have to go to, I believe it's under project, you would have to locate it in the Explorer, and then from there, you would have to drag it from here into your TOC. So if you're trying to go through and add in a whole bunch of topics at the same time, that can be very problematic. And now you can also do this with more than one. So I can use the shift key to select a whole bunch. Let me do this with the mouse. And then I can drag them all up and drop them in here at once, which as you can see is a whole lot faster. So our authors really like that because this saves them a ton of time because they may go through and search for a couple terms and they may drag 50 or 100 topics into the proposal so they can start going through them. So we found that to be very useful. Okay, so some concluding thoughts. some key observations about why Flare was the right choice for us. And so what do I think? It's been about a year since we did this project. So our annual software cost decreased by almost 90%, and that's even with the cost of platinum maintenance that we have for our 30 user licenses. So we were spending in the hundreds of thousands on the software that produced the rules before, and now we're spending in the tens of thousands and in the low tens of thousands. And as a business, we're in control of our own destiny. When we need to make changes to our process or our output, the work can now be done by non-developers, and we can just do it. You know, if a change comes up we need to make, we go in and we test it, we can make it within a day or two instead of making it within, you know, 2 months. And then after getting used to the change, our writers generally have positive feedback about Flare. The similarity in the interface to Microsoft Word with the ribbon up at the top and the same look and feel, I think, went a long way with that because it has a familiar look and feel, and so it didn't seem so new to them. So it kind of looked like something they were used to using, so that helped a lot. Let's see. So my parting advice, and I'll take some questions here at the end if you like as well, is to always think outside of the box and keep poking around, you'll figure it out. You know, we did come across various challenges during the conversion process, and, you know, we just kept after it as a team, running ideas by each other and whatnot, and eventually we would figure out a solution for it. So, and then again tomorrow I'll be doing a find and replace session, which is a little bit more advanced, and so love to have you come join me if you're interested in that. And that's it. My email address is here. You can certainly feel free to contact me if you ever have questions or think I can be of use or just want to show me something cool you did in Flare. That's always great as well. And I'll be happy to entertain any questions. Yeah, so we started with English, and then we translated into the target languages. Now, the translation work had already been done using XML previously, and so every 6 months, our translator have to go through and basically translate the stuff that's changed. And so they were able to use their translation memory that they had from our previous project and kind of run it against the XLIF formatted stuff, so they didn't have to kind of start from scratch. So we did have translation in place already. So, but for new translations, that's exactly what we would do.
And then they updated the translation memory so that it's more specific to Flare?
Yeah, they basically updated their process so that it uses the XLIF files. And they we had previously had started providing them with an XML extract out of our custom software that our developers put together for us. And so they were doing something kind of along those lines already that they kind of custom built themselves anyway. So this just kind of made the whole process, I think, easier for them and easier for us as well. Yes?
You may have covered this, maybe I missed the point. The purpose of using a flat file structure, was that the Microsoft Windows implementation?
That was part of it. So there were really two reasons we used the flat file structure. since we put the rule ID in the file name, it was easier to have them all in one place, so then the authors, if they knew which rule they were looking for, they can just scroll through the list and go right to it. So that was one of the reasons, but definitely running against the file path limitation certainly kind of dissuaded us of any thoughts of actually using the hierarchical structure that we were used to using. And I think it's been a good decision in the long run because, you know, for folks like me, I'm in more of a support role, and I'm not intimately familiar with the content. So, you know, I'd always have to search for something if we had the folder structure in place, whereas now I can just scroll through the list as well if I know which one I'm looking for. Any other questions? Okay, well, I think we're done a little bit. You get about 10 minutes back or so, and I hope this was useful. And thank you very much.